Well, welcome back to Action RC, the podcast series taking you inside RC racing, both now and over the 40 plus years of our history. I'm your host, Scott Guide, and delighted to welcome you to the show. Before we kick off this week, just a quick note to say thanks so much to those of you who've reached out to say you're enjoying the show. One note I had this week was from a guy who's been listening to the show and it's helped inspire his return to competitive racing after years away. That's very cool. Best wishes, Adrian, for the return. I hope you have lots of fun getting back on track, and thanks for making contact. Today, we're digging into the story of a man who kickstarted his RC career right back in the halcyon days of 12th EP On-Road in Southern California, of all the places, the epicenter of RC. He's raced in multiple world's finals. He's been on the podium. He's won a ton of US national championships, a Reedy race. He's also started and run his own company along the way. And 40 years later is still in the heart of the RC industry. It's my absolute pleasure to welcome to the show the one and only Rick Howard. Rick, thanks for joining me. How's 2023 treating you?
It's going well so far. I'm glad to be on the show. And it's a great year for business, and, you know, hope to get some racing in this year. And so far so good.
So before we go back to the beginning then, are you still doing some racing these days yourself? Have you got a transmitter in your hand very often?
Not often, but I do race. I'm not retired, but I have taken a little bit of a break. It's been almost a year and a half since I've raced, but I've got a race coming up at the end of April, touring car on road, and plan to try to win it.
Well, that's excellent. That's just exactly the way it should be. We might come back to that at the end and ask you a bit more about that. There's heaps I want to explore with you. You know, your own personal race history, we'll start there, but I really do want to dig into the peak performance story. I want to talk about what it's like to win a Reedy race, particularly the rise of touring car and all of those sorts of things. But I guess the place to start is, as we often do, in the beginning. So what's your origin story? How did RC get started for you back in the day?
Well, I was always involved with cars, always liked playing with cars as a kid. My dad was a car fanatic, liked motorsports. So I was introduced to cars and racing at a very early age. And I found out about RC car racing accidentally, and I knew I needed to do it. I wanted to race, and that was the best opportunity to do it. I wasn't going to race go-karts. I don't even know if go-karts really existed in my mind at the time. So I'm like, hey, I can race these things. It's, you know, I have some money saved. I can buy a car, and I know that there's some local tracks that I could go to and, you know, become a race car driver in, you know, this small way. And that's sort of how it started, with my dad going to the races with me and racing himself. And, you know, it just kind of blew up from there. I did really well early on, and just kind of progressed almost accidentally.
was it 12 scale racing that you started in? I think that's what I read that somewhere. Have I got that right?
Yes, it was 1/12 at the time. You know, in 1982, there wasn't really, I mean, off-road racing sort of starting out, but it was pretty small. It wasn't bigger than on-road like today, but it was 12 scale, mostly parking lot type temporary tracks in a shopping mall on a Sunday, you know, and some weird areas in LA, but it was racing. So I loved it.
It was pretty full on, wasn't it? In Southern California in those years, 12 scale racing was pretty big and pretty competitive.
Yes, it was. I mean, Southern California is still a bit of the center of kind of the RC world, but even then, you know, Team Associated was in Southern California. A couple other manufacturers were local, and it was really competitive. you know, there were pockets in other areas of the country that were as well, but it was kind of the center of manufacturing, and, you know, the best drivers were in Southern California. So it was a nice place to learn, and the competition was great.
Yeah.
And that helped, you know, helped me improve, definitely having to, you know, try to catch these fast guys that I read about in the magazines.
Yeah. What did you love about it? What got you straight away? I mean, was it just that motorsport kind of thing that you really wanted to be a race car driver? Is it, you know, was the technical stuff kind of capture you pretty quickly, or what really appealed in those early years?
Well, it was really the driving and being a race car driver in some form. The technical aspects it was pretty limited at the time. You know, you had these, you know, a 12 scale car back then was pretty much a flat pan car. There was no suspension.
No.
And the tuning was limited to tires and flex, you know, to get traction. And yeah, the technical aspect didn't interest me as much as the, you know, driving. Driving. And even now I prefer the driving compared to the technical mechanical side.
You are a man after my own heart. If I could have a mechanic to do all the work on my car and just be a racer, that would be so good. I have to ask about racing with your dad. Did you guys race against each other? How quickly did you become the quicker of the two of you?
Well, it started, it's not what a lot of father-son pairs do. He didn't start as my mechanic. I had limited, you know, I didn't know how to solder, for example. Yeah. So, you know, he would help with the things that I couldn't do, or show me how to do the things that I didn't know how to do. And I would do them myself. And after about a year of racing, he was going to the races with me, but, you know, I wasn't the driver and he wasn't the pit crew. He basically was my transportation to the track. So, after a year, he decided, well, I'm going to be at the track. I might as well race myself.
Ah, okay. So you got him into it.
When I stepped up to a new car, he drove my old car.
Okay.
And so he actually started racing about a year after me and did that for a few years. And then when I kind of got old enough to go to the track on my own and start the business, you know, he still went to the races, but he didn't participate. He would just be there.
Or
support spectator. Yeah. And as someone who liked racing in cars, he enjoyed watching the races.
Yeah. Yeah. Give me a bit of a sense of those first few years. I mean, you know, I think you said you started in 82. By 1986, you're winning the Nationals, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But kind of, you know, give me a quick tour through those first 2 or 3 years for you, and when you start looking at those bigger races and, you know, developing as a driver, what was that like for you as a young fella?
Well, like I said, I started off pretty fast, and and at the entry level class at the time was called production class. It was basically a stock motor class, but the cars were out of the box with bushings. You couldn't add bearings. You couldn't change the car. So, this class, it was basically a beginner class. And I remember the first year I raced, I never finished outside of, I think fourth was my worst finish, and every other one was, you know, first, second or third.
Yeah.
So, there wasn't really what you'd call a racing season, and you raced on a Sunday 2 or 3 times a month, and that was it. There was no practice days, nothing else. So not like today. So after this first year, I moved up to stock and did well, and then I started racing modified and did well, and by 1984 I'd top qualifier at the Futaba Grand Prix, which was kind of one of the big Southern California races. And that was sort of when I really kind of realized, hey, this is pretty good. I out-qualified Joel Johnson and the other fast guys at the time. And the Worlds were happening in Denmark in 1984. And Mike Reedy, I suppose he was in charge of the U.S. team, I don't remember correctly, said, hey, you know, you should think about coming to the Worlds. And I convinced my dad that we should go, and that, you know, went to that. And that was kind of my first real taste of international success. I made the A-main in stock at that race, and it was, you know, everyone raced stock and then you race modified. And from then on, it was, you know, I was doing well, winning club races, winning the local, you know, regional races. And that's kind of how it all began, really.
It's asking you to drag yourself a long way back in your mind, but what was it like, you know, that first qualifying heat at that Worlds in 1984, you know, as a young fella, that must have been pretty cool.
It was, yes, because I hadn't raced a lot of, well, racing was different. So when you had a big race was the Nationals, the one Nationals, and everything else was a club race or some kind of a small regional race. You didn't have, you know, this, you know, 10 big races a year that were all sort of the same at the same level. You had this one Worlds every 2 years and, you know, some smaller races. But it was, I mean, I don't even know if I was nervous. It was, I mean, I was pretty confident because I knew I was good.
Yeah.
And it was different only in that it was the it was on carpet. So it was the first time I raced on carpet.
Okay.
But there were a lot of firsts at that race. I mean, that was the first time I raced, and I think a lot of people race with an electronic speed control.
Yeah.
It was the first race with A and B timing.
Hmm.
So it was a lot of new stuff all at once, but yeah, I was definitely nervous, you know. I'm still getting nervous at a big race or even any race, really. But no, it was great. I was pretty happy.
Oh, very much.
Just making the main.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you remind me that, you know, in that era, in those years, there were so many firsts going on all the time, wasn't there? The cars were developing so quickly. The electronics were developing so quickly. The race organization and the sport was developing so quickly. I really like your description of that event being an event of so many firsts. That really was almost how it was on a weekly or monthly basis over that, you know, over that era for all of us. Yeah. So tell me about the Nationals in 1986. I think if I understand rightly, that's your first win. You're up against, you know, I'm assuming people like Tony Nessinger and Joel Johnson. I read somewhere that you decided to stick with the RC12i for that race rather than the new 12L. I don't know if you can tell me a little bit about that, but tell me about that race and, you know, winning that national in 1986.
Okay, without going too far back, well, this was the first race where I had decided with a friend of mine, we were going to start batching batteries and making our own motors.
Okay.
So this was Peak Performance had existed for about a year, just doing tire traction, you know, nothing electronics related. And we decided, hey, let's get into this. So heading into this race, you know, you said I'd chosen the old car, the 12i. I didn't really choose it.
Okay.
It's when, at the time I was running for Associated, and when I quit running Reedy, I basically was no longer on the Associated team. So while everyone else had the 12L prototype at the time, I ran the car I had been running.
Gotcha.
Because
you were now the competition. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it was a little different back then, but yeah, I was now the competition, and it worked out well. I mean, even Associated had on their website for a very long time that, you know, when they listed their wins or you know, national wins in the past, I was running a 12L, but I was running a 12i, and it worked out well, and it probably worked out better that I didn't have a new car just because I was so familiar with the 12i.
Yeah. It was quite a shift, wasn't it, from the I to the L in terms of, you know, I guess the next generation of technology in 12 scale cars. Probably did take a little bit for people to wrap their head around.
Well, at the time, you know, cars now, you have these very small changes, and And when a manufacturer comes out with a new off-road car, touring car, I don't really know that there's this huge gain in speed or handling when they make, you know, you come out with a completely new car and it's a little bit better. Maybe it's a little easier to drive, and over the course of a race, you might gain a little bit of time. But yeah, back then, the changes, you know, you could come out with a new tire or new suspension or add a, you know, rear suspension or add a shock or whatever it is. And, you know, these could make a big difference.
Yeah.
So you always wanted to have that advantage if you could. And, you know, in this 12i situation, I think it I don't know if it's a track, it worked out that the older stuff was good. Better, at least to a point. And changes 12i to 12l, that was a huge deal, and it was especially huge on carpet.
Yeah. That, I guess Associated had started with the 12 Sky Racing in Southern California, mostly being car parks and, you know, tarmac or bitumen or asphalt, however, depending which part of the world you're in. But then carpet really did get into the ascendancy, didn't it? And particularly for international racing by that sort of period of the mid-80s.
Yeah, it had been, well, the U.S. had been split because you had, unlike today, you had carpet racing, but it was limited to our cold weather areas in the winter. And at the time, the outdoor racing or asphalt racing was always 6L, and the indoor carpet racing on these tiny tracks was 4L. So they were quite a bit slower.
Yeah.
But carpet had been around for some time. It's just that you didn't really like cross over. It's like, well, I raced in the West Coast, I always raced on asphalt, and guys who raced in the Midwest, you know, a lot of them race just in the winter on carpet, and maybe they race on asphalt in summer, but it was kind of divided that way.
Yeah.
Now the cars, you know, 6L, or, well, not 6L, you run the same battery, same motor, everything.
Everywhere,
Asphalt or carpet.
We literally just last week had, you know, I'm in Brisbane in Australia, and we just literally last week had a first round of the Asian On-Road Championship, and the guys were running 12 scale modified on a full size tarmac or asphalt 1/8 scale track. And the cars were incredible. It was amazing to see what a modern 12 scale car can do on a, you know, a really large outdoor track. It must be amazing to see them go on an indoor carpet track these days. I'll get to that one day.
It's like a slot car.
Yeah, they're amazing. So in the midst of all of this, you know, 12 Sky Racing, at what point do you start looking at off-road? You know, we're up to sort of, you know, the mid-80s here, 86, we just talked about the Nationals there. Only a couple of years later, you're at the World Championships for off-road in Australia. But at what point in your journey do you start looking at some off-road racing?
It had become more popular. And I don't know if there's a specific reason other than, hey, this is, you know, from a business standpoint, there was a lot of it going on, and, you know, be more popular. You want to be a part of it as a company.
Yeah.
And at the time, you know, Peak Performance, I mean, it was relatively big at some points, but, you know, as a driver who could do well, I mean, I was free. I didn't have to sponsor, you know, I was already sponsoring myself. So it made sense for me to do it. And I did it well. And it suited my driving style. I was always pretty smooth on the throttle, which really helped in 12 scale because of, you know, the runtime considerations. And, you know, it suited off-road at the time because off-road wasn't raced on these super high bite tracks or carpet tracks. You had to have a smooth touch on the throttle just to kind of, you know, control the car and get around the track. And that helped. And, you know, I did well, and we had this local track in the area, so I could race and started racing off-road, and that became more interesting. I think there's a lot of more competition. And it just was, you know, it appeared to be, you know, the way things were headed.
Yeah, those exciting times. That, you know, that reminds me that I read an interview, and I can't remember who it was with, but in the interview, whoever it was talking about you as a driver and said that, you know, sometimes you drove so smoothly that the car barely appeared to be moving. Like, you know, you were just so smooth as a driver, you, Rick. I can't remember the interview was with, but they were talking about you. And it struck me that, you know, that might just be something that you picked up growing up racing 12 scale, and, you know, that era when runtime was so hard to find and, you know, traction was so hard to find because the tires weren't that developed and all of those, you know, so it made me curious about to what degree those habits you learned in, you know, the early 80s 12 scale on tarmac carried right through your career.
It was a huge advantage in 12 scale because you're basically, you know, battery was the limitation. And if you could drive smoothly and conserve the battery, you could use a faster motor, you could do a lot of things that gave you an advantage. In off-road, it wasn't an advantage, you know, runtime wasn't ever really an issue in off-road, but it sort of, you know, that smooth throttle carried over into off-road, and it's like, oh, it's an advantage here too, it's just a different advantage. It's one of those things where, you know, people would kind of, you know, at the time, you know, we didn't have A and B and all that. People would be standing there with stopwatches taking lap times. And a lot of people wouldn't time me because it didn't look like I was going fast. I wasn't, you know, breaking the rear end loose.
Yeah.
Wasn't throwing a big rooster tail or doing anything crazy. I was just getting around the track smoothly. And, you know, I didn't look as fast as other people, but on the stopwatch I was faster. A lot of people say, yeah, you look slow out there, and, you know, but you're going fast. That was a pretty common comment about me when I was practicing, or, you know, people were timing me.
It is still something that's visible today, I think, in, you know, in elite drivers, off-road, on-road, it doesn't matter. You know, there's something about the capacity. I've watched a lot of Kyle McBride racing off-road, for example, and he never looks like he's going fast, but the lap times don't lie. Yeah, it's really important. So just talk to me about those couple of years, because by the time we get to 1989 at St Ives for the World Championship, which I think is your first off-road World Championship, you're driving with Kyosho. So where did that partnership emerge over that first part of your off-road time?
Well, I have to think about it a little bit. At that time, I was using Associated off-road cars, and I was probably getting a little bit of help from them, just because I was doing, you know, there wasn't really any other option. You know, there's Kyosho, but it was one of those things where they wanted to have me running their car, but at the time Associated did their two-wheel car, and they were running the Yokomo cars in four-wheel drive. At the time, I was sponsored by Futaba, and the importer of Futaba was also the importer of Kyosho. So that's how I got linked in with Kyosho, was through this Futaba sponsorship in the U.S. And that was that was how that all started.
Okay. And so tell me a little bit about your experience of that World Championships in Sydney in 1989, St Ives Showgrounds, that, you know, super low traction, fast, flat, not many jumps, kind of under the trees, you know, very iconic racetrack for us in Australia. How did that event shake out for you?
Well, it was interesting because not, you know, using Associated cars, I was there with Chris McElroy, who was a guy who I traveled to races with at the time. He ran Associated. I believe he ran Associated cars too, but we had no idea that there were any special cars. We had we got there and kind of found out, hey, we don't have these new cars. We don't have access to the tires.
The tires.
So it was kind of like, oh man, we're at this, a little bit of a disadvantage, and whether that made a difference or not in our finishing positions, I don't know. But it was a great race. I mean, it was really fun outside of the racing. I can't say two-wheel I was super happy with my results, because at the time I just expected, you know, I'm supposed to be in the A main. I'm not supposed to be in the B main, or I think I finished in the B main, but you know, I'm supposed to be racing for the win. So, you know, if I wasn't racing for the win, or had the speed to race for the win, I wasn't very happy about it. But four-wheel drive was a completely different story. And, you know, that track was, I think it had one jump on it. So, you know, which was the case for a lot of off-road tracks back then. They weren't like supercross, motocross tracks like they are now. No. So that also suited my driving style and experience with on-road. But, you know, we got four-wheel drive, and, you know, the car was pretty good. I was fast from the outset. But one of the interesting things is the tire thing kind of, the car, the stealth car, the associated car, that was a big deal. But also the Yokomo tires were a big deal. And Losi at that race had, I don't know if they were prototypes or brand new or what they were, but they had their X pattern tire, which was a hot tire at the time, or became a hot tire at the time. And they gave me some of those to use in four wheel.
Okay.
I don't even know what I would have used on the front. Maybe I used them. I don't even remember, but they wanted to beat the associated guys or Yokomo guys so bad that they gave me Losi tires for the Kyosho car to help me compete or try to beat them. And I was pretty shocked to get third, to be honest. I don't even remember thinking when I was done that I finished third. It was only like, well, maybe I did, you know, and it turns out I did. So that was really the time. That was probably the highlight of my RC racing career, even though it was off road and I hadn't been doing it very long, but it was kind of a shocking thing. I don't think anyone expected it, but that was a great trip. It was a lot of fun, and it was remembered for the associated 1-2-3 and two wheel,
for you to put that car on the podium, and I'm actually just looking at a photo of the car now, and it almost looks like their Shoemaker Cat 3-row spike front tires, if that's actually your car, but it's hard to say. I think one of the interesting things for me about that Worlds is that it almost, you know, the whole story is about Yokomo and Masami and, you know, those tires, and that's kind of the whole story, and other things go under the radar, and one of them is, you know, you putting that Kyosho laser onto the podium with your own motor. So I want to ask you about that. What does that feel like, not only to be there on the podium at a Worlds, but to do it with your own motor in the car?
Well, I mean, it's super satisfying because I always was happy to see Peak products do well. I mean, doing it, you know, this whole package was nice. And from a marketing perspective, you know, it's great. And it sort of validates, you know, I'm spending all this money to go here, you know, partially because it's a hobby, but also because it's a business. So to do well, I'd say, man, this trip really paid off. We had a great time, finished well. You know, money well spent it was great.
Very cool. There's a couple of particular races I want to ask you about that are not Worlds, but before we do that, you know, I just wanted to, you know, making a note that you're in Worlds A finals again multiple times. That's your first kind of podium, or I think only podium at a Worlds, but you're in the finals again in 93, 97, 99, 2003, 2007, a bunch of times. Are there any of those other world championships that you, in 10 scale off-road, that you particularly remember fondly as great events to be at?
I suppose the best races are where I did well.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all fun in their own way, from, you know, like, you know, just the traveling and seeing people and driving and all that. But really the only other off-road worlds that I felt like super satisfied was in Japan, and I don't even remember the date. It had to be 2000, I think it was 2007.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
In Japan, that was probably the other most memorable. Was the race kind of on the mountain at the ski resort, how I remember it.
Yeah.
But no, that was good. They were all memorable. Some were not so memorable. Race in 91 and in Detroit, even though I had the stealth car, the prototype car, that was pretty disappointing because I thought I should have done better. But there are a few. I never did that well, in my opinion. I mean, I always was competitive, but I never had the speed to win, which, you know, as things progressed more, practice, I never was a big practice person.
Yeah, okay.
So it, you know, as things turned more pro, it was more difficult to compete and run the business and work and do everything else.
Yeah, fair. So before
I do want to go back to the 89 race. I don't know if you know the story about the pictures of the stealth cars.
No. Tell me the story, Rick. Tell me the story.
Okay. I don't know how it actually went down, but you know Andrew Bolton.
His
brother
yes.
was there taking
yes.
taking photos, and somehow I got a photo of the cars without the bodies off, and there was some type of confrontation, and there was a
kerfuffle.
Whoever the associated guys in charge at the time, I don't even know how they could manage to do this. Somehow I got made them take the film out of the cameras and pack, you know, film in the camera days, and made them give it up. And I don't even know, I mean, today that couldn't even be possible and wouldn't even be expected, you know, if you allow the car to be photographed with the body off, that's your own fault.
That's
but
right.
Maybe he took the body off. I don't remember the story, but it was kind of interesting because now, you know, everything's so wide open with the internet. But back then, you know, guy gets a picture of your car and they make you take the film out of the camera. So that was pretty funny.
I think now that you tell me that story, I think Andrew Bolton has told me that story before. And actually, we had Andrew on this show a couple of years ago. So, if you want to hear that story from an Australian perspective, you know, you can dig into our back catalogue and find Andrew. But yeah, you're right. That was the era we were in, wasn't it? And particularly those worlds over that period that had these incredible handmade prototype cars, you know, not something we really see anymore.
And not in the same way, definitely. No.
Yeah, not so obvious. So before we leave the off-road scene, because I really want to dig into the peak story and then I'll talk about on-road a bit more, but two particular races I did want to ask you about. One is winning a Reedy race. You know, I think you win the Reedy race in 1992. And in that era, the Reedy race really was, well, certainly for those outside the US, it felt like second only to the Worlds. And some people would say it's harder to win. What was that like, winning a Reedy race for you?
Oh, it was great. I mean, that was the race to win. And it was at, you know, kind of in our backyard home track, which was an advantage. But the reality is the U.S. racers were the top drivers at the time. It wasn't, you know, other than Masami. You know, even though it was my home track, it was, you know, Cliff Lett's home track and Jay Halsey, you know, it was everybody's home track. So there was an advantage being the home track, but there was a lot of people who had that same advantage. But it was an amazing race, and it was extremely, you know, it's prestigious now, or at least up until it stopped running. Back then, it was, you know, there were a lot of people. It was a huge deal. So to win it was, it was a highlight at that point. Probably the best, biggest race I've ever won, and most rewarding, just because it, you know, you kind of took the two wheel and the four wheel.
Yeah.
all around win. But no, it was amazing. It was great. And, you know, my family was there, and, you know, at the time it wasn't like, oh, well, so-and-so, he didn't come, if he was here. I mean, literally every fast guy was racing. So
yeah, I'm looking at the list right now, and there's nobody missing, that's for sure. Yeah. I will.
No excuses.
No. For listeners, I'll put a link in the show notes to one of the magazine articles. In fact, you can go to readyrace.com and find scans of lots of the stories from the Ready Races over that period. But I'll put a particular link to this one. There's a lovely photo of you, Rick, a young, very happy looking Rick out holding the Kyosho four-wheel drive that you're running at that time, winning that race. Yeah. The other one I wanted to ask you about, which is back on the on-road side, but in that same period, is the US Nationals. In 1990 or 91, I think, you sweep all three classes at the on-road US Nationals, Twalska 4 and 6L and Pro 10. I'm just assuming, you know, all I've got is the results, but everything must have just clicked for you that weekend. This must be just a week, one of those magical weekends where everything goes right. Is that how it was?
Well, at the time, there was 4L, which was a separate, there was 6L. I mean, they were all technically separate events. The 4L was at a different venue.
Okay.
And then the on-road was, there's 6L, 12 scale, followed by the 10 scale.
Okay.
So the 6L, 4L was on carpet in Detroit, Michigan. And then this 6L carpet. This was a time when carpet was kind of becoming a fad, but a transition. So we were in, you know, hot weather, Dallas, Texas, and racing indoor on carpet. And then right after that, we ran the Pro 10 outside on a asphalt track. Why we didn't race 12 scale outside, I don't know. Maybe, I think it was just a fad. It was this transition time.
Yeah.
But everything sort of did click in the 4L race. I wasn't really, I don't know that I was expected to do well. I mean, I knew I could do well, but I didn't qualify particularly well. I was fourth or fifth, and I just had to work my way up through the pack. And I was probably the fastest car in the main and, you know, got into the lead and won. And I used a lot of extra just trying to catch up and move through the field that I dumped. So I was pretty slow right at the end, but I won by probably five feet at the most. I just started to slow and the guys I passed were coming back on me. So it was pretty close. And the 6L was almost the same thing. I don't remember how I qualified, but, it was a bit of the same thing where I had to drive hard and use more battery than I wanted to. And I mean, I think I literally won by 2 or 3 feet. So, you know, both wins were by this slim margin, but it doesn't really matter how much you win by as long as you win.
First to the line.
That's the important thing.
Yeah.
And then the Pro 10 outside, I think that was more normal. I mean, it wasn't, obviously there was a lot of competition, but it wasn't, there's nothing odd about it. I don't remember TQing, but I did win. I think, I'm pretty sure Cliff Ladd got second. So at the time, you know, competition was really good at that time.
Yeah.
Still an on road. I don't want to say tapered off. I don't want to slight the racers after me, but off-road was beginning to get more popular and on-road, and that's kind of when I really started to move more into, you know, after that race, I really started to move more into off-road.
As
a full-time deal.
It did. I mean, that is definitely the case that, you know, on-road had kind of trailed off by the mid 90s, and it really wasn't until the explosion of the touring cars, which we'll get to a little bit later on. Just before we kind of go to the peak story, I'm curious. I've always been curious about, you know, that the level of competition in the US is so high, and you have so many of the world's best drivers. But just it makes me curious what it's like then when you do get to race against, you know, the best from other parts of the world. You know, is it like for everyone else going to a world title, it's the biggest kind of thing. It's way, way bigger than a national championship event, even a European championship, I would argue. You know, but for the US, the level of competition is so high at a national level. Does international racing feel like another step up? How much do you look forward to, you know, seeing the best from other parts of the world at these kind of world level events?
Well, in general, I like the most competition possible. And in off-road at the time, you know, it wasn't like, you know, oh gosh, we're going to go to Europe and get smoked, or, you know, we're going to race against these guys and they're going to beat us, at least back, you know, as I was kind of coming up through the ranks. And now, nowadays, you know, as I kind of moved into touring car, you know, the probably started off as more of a U.S. dominated thing, but quickly moved to, you know, Europeans and the drivers from Asia being more dominant. And that's obviously how it is now. There aren't a whole lot of drivers in the U.S. that I mean, they're fast drivers for sure, but not ones that, you know, go to the ETS or or AOC or any of these races. It's they're fast in the U.S. And when Europeans come, you know, or foreigners come to the U.S., the U.S. drivers give them a lot of competition. But definitely we're kind of behind the
other drivers. The center of gravity has shifted, hasn't it? In touring car racing in particular, or on-road in particular. It's not the case in off-road. Yes. It's a different story, but...
No, off-road, it's a little bit of a mixture, and a lot of it depends more, you know, the U.S. tracks are still different, quite a bit different than European tracks and, like, you know, nitro buggy, and even in 1/10, where, you know, we're still racing on a lot of dirt, but we're starting to get in a carpet here in the U.S., where there's carpet and turf are more common in Europe, and you know, there's drivers that are more specialized, you know, and they don't necessarily cross over into other
disciplines. So
there's carpet off-road guys, they're not dirt off-road guys, it's definitely kind of spread apart into almost two separate, kind of use the same cars, but it's really two separate types of racing.
Well, we'll see if we have time to dip back into a bit of that at the end. Let's kind of get to the peak story, because this is really a story I want to dig into with you. So, you know, you mentioned earlier that 86 Nationals, you know, you'd kind of been dabbling with the company for a little while, and that's where you first started to do batteries and motors. But kind of give me, you know, tell me the story of where the peak idea came from, how you got started. What was that like, that first few years of the company?
Well, the start was, I had worked part-time for a guy called Big Jim Greenmeyer. People may know if you've been around long enough, and he had a company called Team Checkpoint. So I got a summer job there it would have been 1984. And I didn't have any experience with motors, but I kind of did some basic things around this shop. You know, I filled up some tire traction bottles, and I tore down some motors to be built as modified motors. So some very basic things. So I kind of got a taste of that. And then I had a friend, Mike Hickman, who with his brothers knew how to build some motors and had done some on their own, you know, just not really as a company, but more like, hey, we can build, you know, put some motors together.
Yeah.
And for people that don't know, you've got a modified motor, and the term is, I mean, it was really a modified motor. You'd take a Mabuchi motor and the existing Mabuchi motor, you'd tear it apart, unwind it, you know, put new wire on it, put ball bearings in it, put it all back together and tune it. So that's where the term modified motor came from. Later, it transitioned into pre-built, you know, parts that weren't modified. They're built to be made. But anyway, we paired up and said, hey, you know, we can do this. And we bought some parts from Kevin Orton, who worked for a company called Delta, who made cars and electronics. And Kevin Orton moved to California and started Tekken. So we knew Kevin Orton, and he had these parts that he brought with him to Southern California to start Tekken. He didn't need them, and he sold them to us. So it's like, okay, now we're in the motor business. We've got these parts that we can build some motors and get this thing going. And at the same time, unlike today where you have all this testing equipment that's pretty easy to buy, we needed some way to test batteries, which at the time was basically just discharging batteries and timing how long they would go at a constant discharge current. And he had this old discharger that he'd bought from Trinity, and he sold that to us. He wasn't supposed to sell it to us, and Ernie Provetti found out later, Trinity Ernie Provetti, and apparently was pretty pissed off that he sold it to us and put us in business. So that's how it all got started. We bought some batteries. We had these motors. We built them, you know, how we knew how to build them, and that's how the company got started in the motor and battery business, basically combined between Mike Hickman's garage and the living room at my parents' house is kind of the early beginnings of that.
So many good ideas start just like that, don't they? Yeah.
And we didn't have anything special or anything innovative at the time in these parts. You know, the speed wasn't so important. So, you know, I mean, the motors were good, but I don't even remember if they were like the latest thing or how good they were, the base parts were. But the main thing at the time was having good batteries. And the machine we bought was pretty good. We could match the batteries, the subsea batteries, well. And just kind of worked out, and I won this race first time out with these motors and batteries, and that it kind of took off from there.
Yeah.
Almost accidentally, because you know the hobby was growing and people needed stuff, and we started getting inquiries from other areas.
Yeah.
Shortly after that, I ended up my partner, he wasn't really interested anymore, so I bought his half, and then I owned everything, and it kind of blew up from there.
Away it went. So let's I mean, maybe not in those well two things. Firstly, I had no idea that was the origin of the name Modified Motors, which ironically we still use today for motors that are anything but modified. They're built in the factory that way, but that's a really good origin story. But secondly, I'd love to just nerd out a little bit for all the RC motor buffs out there. And maybe we're fast forwarding it, you know, a few years to where it's a bit more sophisticated. But what goes into, Rick, what goes into designing and building, you know, a race-worthy mod motor in that era? You know, we've got teardowns coming in from Japan, I think either Yokomo or Kyosho, and then you build from there. Is that how it goes?
That's how it worked. And it wasn't all that difficult. And I think people have probably, they've heard the story where Trinity and Joel Johnson went to Japan and get a deal with Kyosho, and all of a sudden they're, you know, huge. It wasn't easy to just find these parts, and you almost had to know somebody. You know, Mike Reedy was connected to Yokomo, so he had this Japanese connection. Trinity was connected to Kyosho, so they had this access. And, you know, we'd started off with these, I think they were Kyosho motors that we started with. But our real connection to get started was with HPI.
Okay.
HPI was two guys basically doing what I was doing. They were just starting off in their parents' house in Newport Beach, California. And they had these connections, so we had a way to get these teardown motors from them. So that was the key to even being able to move forward, is having access. China. There was no such thing as buying stuff from China.
No,
it wasn't.
No.
It wasn't even a thing. It was, you know, the motors were made in Japan. So we had access to these motors that HPI could get for us. And then they were our distributor in Japan, and it worked out really well. You know, it was a good partnership. And obviously HPI's, you know, got to be pretty huge, you know, in a completely different yeah. way. But they did start off small. They were just a couple guys,
working
in the living room with their parents' house. You know, it's how it starts. But to make the motors, it was basically knowing what to do. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, you have to epoxy resin the motors, mm-hmm. and you have to know where to get this stuff and where to, you know, there's a lot of little things you have to learn and secrets and tricks just to make things reliable. That's pretty much where the you know, if you can make something more reliable, or you could wind it tighter and put more wire on it, or have better batteries to go along with something that has more power that can get you through the 8-minute race. Hmm. So I'd say there weren't a whole lot of tricks, but that's how you made a good motor, is, you know, and you had to have someone make it look good too.
Yeah. Which reminds me, just that you know, that name HPI and that story you've just told us, that's a name that many of us in the rest of the world did not hear until a certain Masami Hirasaka, you know, wins in the Worlds in 1987 in the UK with a HPI motor on board. That's, you know, for many of us in other parts of the world, that's the first time we hear that name. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a bit of that was an interesting, I mean, we never had any kind of proof, but we suspected that was one of our motors that they'd relabeled.
Oh, really?
At the time. Yeah, because they were selling our motors in Japan. And there was no proof. I mean, it just seemed suspicious at the time that all of a sudden this guy who's also HPI goes out and wins, and they have all these, you know, motors and stuff,
yeah.
which may or may not have been the case, but.
Good story, isn't it?
Yeah. Masami is a great guy. I met Masami because HPI brought me to Japan in, I don't even remember, it was 85 or 86. I raced at there's a horse racing stadium, and they had a track set up. There's might have been Japanese nationals. So that's the first time I met Masami.
Yeah.
And that was an interesting trip. But he's a great guy. And the HPI guys, that they really got things going, and without them, we probably wouldn't have, you know, Peak wouldn't have been ever gotten to the point where I did.
You know, as you think back on those times and the motors that you were building, and, you know, I guess I think about all the different wines and the different kinds of designs over the years, but were there a couple of favorites for you, you know, particular wines for particular disciplines or motors that you just really loved that, you know, were coming out of your factory, out of your garage, wherever the winding was happening?
Well, at the time, things progressed pretty quickly. So, and the cars, especially in off-road, on-road, we were limited by battery, and off-road, you were limited by traction.
Yeah.
So if you could run a faster motor, get more traction, you could run a faster motor in off-road. If you could make your batteries last longer in on-road, you could run a faster motor. But probably my two favorites, in 12 scale, when I won the Nationals in 86, actually probably not even 86, it was 87 was the next year. I didn't win mod. I TQ'd mod and I won stock, but I ran a 22-turn motor. And it's hard to explain because people now, I mean, 22 turns, I mean, you know, we're running 17 turns. It's not the same, but
it's different. Yeah.
I was using a 22 turn motor at the time when people were running 25 turn motors.
Yeah.
So I was able to make the 22 turn motor go 8 minutes while other people would have a problem. So I immediately had an advantage because I had more, more power available. And that, I'd say that was probably my favorite motor of that era. And people didn't believe it at the time. It's like, there's no way you can't run that. How are you gonna make run time? So that was kind of cool, just, you know, them not believing it. And then the 13 triple wound motor is what I used in 89 in at the St. Ives Worlds. And that's what we eventually named the Rick's Pick motors, 13 triple.
Yeah.
So those are the two I remember the most. And naming it after myself.
That's obviously it's your company. I was just going to confess that the Rick's Pick was one of my favorites, in that era as well. I had one of those in my car for quite a while and really loved it. It was a good motor. So well done.
A lot of that was probably one of the more popular wines at the time. And, we're getting into the hot pink era too. So it was hot pink label. So it was a good motor.
I would almost say the Rick's Pick and the 12 single Losi Motown Missile were my two favorite motors of that era of all time. I love those things. Wanting to get into a "it was way better back then" kind of a conversation, I've been watching some footage from the late kind of brushed motor era of touring cars, the early 2000s. Those things sounded insane. Do you kind of miss, the brushed motor days a little bit, or the sound of them? Rick, is that something you kind of go, "Oh, that was good. I wish we still had that"?
Not so much. It was at the time, looking back now, it's like, "Oh, that was pretty good," because brushless has turned into the mod brushless isn't a big deal. You got way more power. Yeah. But I think I miss the brushed stock motors, even though I don't race it, but from a fan of RC racing. I miss that because it was a lot simpler and less expensive. And now with brushless stock motors, they're too fast and they're too expensive. And it's kind of changed those classes. It's not really.
Yeah.
I always thought of the stock classes as a bridge to modify, but now it's a destination. Factory drivers and people getting paid and bonuses and full factory rides to race these stock classes, which I don't care for.
But no, it's a different
sound of the motors the sound of the motors was definitely pretty awesome. But at the time when you're listening to these things, when the first brushless motors came out, I remember using them and thinking, "This is awesome!" Like,
yeah, that's right.
Because it was just a different. If it was a different sound and a different feel, and it's like, man, this is really incredible. But the sound was sort of. It was. I think it was more secondary. Hmm. Now all of a sudden you got more power than you need. It was different.
I do certainly recall that at the end of brush motors in touring car, that in that discipline in particular, it was extremely hard on the motors, and throwing wines and destroying motors was not uncommon at all. That those brush motors were being pushed to their absolute limit by sort of 2006 when brushless started to appear. Yeah, it's a different. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what softened the blow moving to brushless too. Is that there were a lot of problems with the reliability and speed, and at the time we were rebuilding them, or at least putting new. Cutting the comm and putting new brushes in
every run
in a big race. And I mean, nowadays it's like, man, people don't realize you were taking your motor out, unsoldering it after every run, and then either rebuilding it yourself, giving it to someone to rebuild, like a Mike Reedy, we had a guy going to races tuning motors. Yeah, it was really a hassle. Like that, I don't even think people would accept it.
No, I certainly wouldn't.
It was so much simpler.
I don't want to go back to that. Yeah, I'm very happy with never having to look at the motor. That's just fine. Before we leave the peak story, your comment there about having someone with you at races just reminds me to kind of, you know, it's such a hyper competitive world, the motor world, and you guys go up against Reedy and Trinity and LRP from Europe, and, you know, Twister, Mike Walker, you know, his crew, and just how competitive was it in the horsepower game, you know, over the period that you were running Peak?
It was competitive. I mean, having, you know, it was a different kind of tuning. Like now, you know, batteries always made a difference at the time, but you know, you had like brushes were a huge and springs and tuning was that. That's kind of where things moved, and that's what, you know, that was where you you didn't have, you know, everything's done through the speed control now. So if you want a little more power, you want a little more torque, you want a little less or a little more, you know. You know, anything, you know, you would do that through brushes and springs. So that was a big, big hassle. And just dialing that in for the driver was difficult. And we had, you know, I mean, Mike Reedy went to all the races and Jim Dieter for Trinity and, you know, Mike Walker and even, you know, we had a guy going to races to help out, and we had a full, the Peak Factory team was like any other. I mean, looking back, it's like, man, I spent a lot of money that I probably didn't need to spend. Cause I mean, I paid for a guy to go to the races to tune motors for the team. And I probably sent three or four drivers, you know, paid their way. And you know, we sold a lot of motors back then, looking back, and everybody sold a lot of motors. I mean, RC racing was huge. So, you know, we didn't do a lot of advertising. Our advertising was done on the track. So to win races, and that was the important thing. That's how we sold motors, and that's how we advertised. It was super competitive, just, you know, and it was super serious too. There was a lot of money involved, and it was pretty cutthroat.
So, it sounds like there's some stories about it being cutthroat, but maybe we'll save those for another day. We're going to run out of time very quickly. Eventually, you know, there's, you know, years later, you sell the company. And I guess I'm curious, you know, how hard was it for you to let go of your baby, the thing that, you know, you'd imagined and built from 1985 through, you know, I guess it was around 20 years, kind of in different ways. Was it a hard thing to let go of?
Yes and no. It was, you were kind of at a transition time. So it was 1998. So I'd started the business. Technically it was 85. We started with tire, you know, some trinkets and stuff. And then 86 is when we started the motors, and then I sold it in 98.
Okay.
And at the time we were in a kind of a transition period where it was difficult to get batteries. It was difficult to get the teardowns, and it was time to make a big investment or move on. And I had Peak Performance was the distributor for Team Orion batteries. Team Orion started selling their own motors, so we kind of parted ways. But I thought, well, maybe, you know, Team Orion would like to buy Peak because it would give them another brand to sell and to offer to distributors in territories where they already sold Team Orion products. And I don't regret it at all. I think lipos and brushless kind of came in probably, I don't remember exactly. I know lipos were in, you know, the mid 2000s kind of started to come on, and then, brushless motors probably, you know, starting to appear. I think Ronald Volker ran a brushless motor in 06 at the Worlds. Was the only one in the main, if I remember the year correctly.
That'll be right.
06. It was 06. So that gap there, if that had been smaller and I could have somehow transitioned into brushless and lipo, I think it would have been better to continue, but that wasn't even on the radar at the time. It was I don't want to, I just had been married for a few years, and it was just, it wasn't the right time to invest. And so, yep, I decided, hey, you know, I'm going to talk to Team Orion, and they were interested. And at the time, I agreed to stay on for 2 years, which, you know, 98 to 2000. And I ended up staying on for another 7 years.
Okay. Yeah.
Running Team Orion and Peak in the U.S.
In the U.S. Yep.
So there was no, you know, it worked out really well. I mean, I got some money.
Yeah.
I had a job and I didn't have to worry like, you know, like owning your own business. There's always some, you know, like, worries. It was a lot simpler.
Yeah.
And I probably made more money anyway. So
it worked out. It worked out all right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, however it worked out in the end, certainly Peak Performance, a name that, you know, was significant to many of us around the world and goes down in the history books in that sense as a significant part of the story of the sport in the 80s and 90s. Rick,
I actually tried to buy it back a couple of times.
Okay.
But I think Team Orion had sold it to Kyosho and Kyosho wasn't interested. So, yeah, that's how that worked out. So now it's gone. It's probably, the name lives on and I think it still exists, but, it's probably not worth, I mean, it'd be just as easy to start a new company than to revive that name because it's just too old.
That's right. For many modern races, it's not a name they'd be familiar with. Yeah. But for some of us, it's close to our hearts. Certainly that was the story for me. Rick, let's fast forward a bit to the later 1990s and the rise of touring car. You know, it came on the back of Tamiya releasing, you know, some of those little scale touring cars in the early 90s. But it exploded all over the world. And so I guess I'm curious about what you remember from that, you know, that later 90s period as touring car started to explode. How quick were you to head for touring car racing? You know, what did that transition period look like for you?
Well, I was involved at the very beginning because with the touring cars and this on-road racing, we sort of started doing the parking lot racing again. So everything kind of went full circle. You know, you started racing in parking lots with the 12 scale cars in the 80s, and all of a sudden we're back to setting up tracks with these, you know, Tamiya touring cars and later, you know, Yokomo, you know, off-road kind of conversions of making an on-road car out of an off-road car. So I raced the very beginning of that, and then somehow I don't know, as it started getting more serious, I wasn't as interested. And I don't remember exactly why I didn't race, but I mean, I was racing every weekend for a while with a Tamiya. It was the Alfa Romeo T. I don't even remember what the model was, but it was the shaft drive touring car.
TAO2 or a TAO3. Yeah.
It might have been a TAO3, but it was a, you know, at the time, you ran a 15 turn bushing brushed motor with no adjustable timing. It was a very basic motor. It started to get more serious. I didn't race. And even at the beginning of the, I think the first Reedy touring car race of champions was in 98. And I didn't really race much. I ran the World Cup, but beyond World Cup in England, but beyond that, I didn't really race for a while touring car. I kind of came in a little later, seriously.
Yeah.
But no, it was a huge transition because, I mean, it was a whole new category and it blew up and it was just, that was the thing to do. All the best drivers were racing it. It was super competitive. And for me, I needed, I have to have like a motivation, and the competition or a lot of competition is my motivation. So that was something I really enjoyed.
It certainly did attract the best drive, certainly all the best electric drivers from around the world, didn't it? And people came from off-road and all sorts of different places to come and race touring car.
Yes.
Just on the way through. So tell me about that 1998 World Cup event in the UK. David Spashett dominates the kind of 12th and 10th World Championships and that ISTC World Cup, that first kind of pseudo World Championship event. What was that event like to be at? It was an indoor carpet, I think, if I've understood it rightly. Is that right?
Yeah, it was indoor carpet in a sports hall. I don't remember even how I went. I mean, I was running for, I kind of switched off. I ran Team Associated and Losi sort of on and off for a very long time. And at the time I was running for Losi. So I ran a street weapon at the time.
Yeah.
And I flew in just for the World Cup part. I didn't race. Really racing 12th and Pro 10 anymore. And it went well. It was the Reedy race style. So it wasn't like IFMAR qualifying with mains. And it was mixed heats throughout the entire field. So I don't know how they came up with the heats or if it was even fair, to be honest. I just raced and did well. So I remember I finished 10th.
Yeah.
Which I thought was good. And Losi, on the back of Spachette winning, we won what would have been the team prize. And I think they added up maybe five or six guys on each team and they took four or five best scores we won that. So that was pretty cool. That was I was kind of there by myself. I think I stayed with the Losi guys once I got there. I didn't have a car. I think I rode them back to and from the track with Jim Dieter. I don't know why I would have gone with Jim Dieter, but that's what I remember.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was fun. I mean, I enjoy most races, the atmosphere and everything. And that was super competitive. So I had a good time.
There's some footage around from that race, which I've, again, in my preparation for chatting with you today, I've been kind of digging into archives and finding footage, and it's pretty cool to watch that first world level kind of touring car race, and to compare them to what those cars are capable of now is almost night and day, but for the era, they were pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know what tires I remember traction rolling a lot and, we just didn't know, that it was still very new to a lot of people, but it was fun. I remember the track. It was, the European carpet tracks are more, I would consider them, they're like an asphalt outdoor track, but laid out with carpet, whereas the carpet tracks in the U.S. are, tiny little mazes that, are difficult to get around. So there's a huge difference. And I remember that is a really good track. This is like carpet surface, but it races like a, it's laid out like an outdoor track.
A proper nice track.
Yeah. It's bigger and a little more flowing than what you'd see here in the U.S.
Is that the kind of racetrack that you prefer? The bigger, faster, flowy sort of style of racetrack over the tighter, twistier, more technical kinds of things over the span of your career?
Well, I definitely prefer asphalt or outdoor, whatever it is, compared to carpet.
Yeah.
Carpet is okay. For 12 scale, I prefer carpet, but for touring car, rubber tire, asphalt, a bigger track, more flowing, that I prefer that, you can not make a mistake, but you can, it's more forgiving. So you do make a mistake. You're not, tearing off the front suspension or, destroying the body
on a board. And
it's not. Yeah. It's just, it's just bigger and faster and the higher, the speeds are high, the top speeds are sustained for longer. To me, it's more exciting. It's hot, or it can be hot or it can be cold. There's, you kind of have to tune a little more for the weather conditions, at least, tires and even the motor and speed control. You can't just, you have to say, okay, well, you know, it's 105 Fahrenheit out. You can't go with maximum turbo and expect the thing to survive all the time.
Yeah, that's right.
Definitely asphalt outdoors, what I prefer.
It's the place. I you know, I mentioned that Asian On-Road Championship Series race we did here in Australia a couple of weeks ago, and it's actually the first time I've encountered top-level touring car racing for a few years. I've been out of the sport for a few years, and to stand trackside and watch, Mark Reinhardt was here, and to stand trackside and watch what he and the other leading guys, you know, what those cars are capable of now on, you know, again, a full-size 8-scale, well, what was originally an 8-scale outdoor track was incredible. The cars are amazing. Yeah. So, Rick, tell me about those next couple of years. You know, you go on a bit of a run of a final appearances through the 2000s in World Championships in off-road, but also in on-road. By 2006, which is, I think, the year Andy Moore wins in Italy, you're qualifying fifth, you're in the A final. You know, you're probably the US, the leading US touring car racer, you know, by that point. You must have dived back in a bit more seriously sometime after 1998.
Yeah, that was, I ended up with Tamiya, driving Tamiya cars, and I drove Tamiya there, and it was I didn't run Tamiya very long, but I had success. I had that race, the 12 scale part, I did, it was terrible. I don't remember how I did it. I just borrowed a car, and I just did it because it was going to be there. So I figured I might as well race full scale. But the touring car went really well. And that was, I was still using brushed. Most people were using brushed except for Volker. Qualified fifth. I mean, I remember I was seated in the B. Somehow I was in the B qualifier, which worked out because I won. And I started at first in the B qualifier. I remember this because I thought it was very unusual. As I started first every round of qualifying because I maintained the top qualifying time from anyone in the heat. So I started first every time, and I never passed anybody. It was so clean that I never encountered any traffic either. So it was really, I don't want to say it was easy, but...
No, but that's dream conditions, isn't it? That's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, it could have been way more difficult. So I qualified well. I qualified right behind Reinhardt, who was me also. And the track suited me. And I was actually leading my first main, I think I got taken out. Second main, I was leading until maybe the last lap, and my speed control failed. And that was really disappointing I don't think I could have done well enough to win in the third qualifier, just starting fifth, but I ended up finishing 10th overall. And, you know, even if I finished second in that second main, it would have improved, and I would have been, you know,
in the midfield somewhere,
not 10th. So, 10th, you know, making the main, that's great, but it doesn't reflect how competitive I was.
It was an incredible era in touring car too, for the biggest story of, I mean, you know, we read history back into it, don't we? But the biggest story that was going on of, you know, Masami Hirasaka's won world championships in every discipline except touring car. And you can watch those finals back through that lens now and see, you know, the kind of extraordinary efforts that he was going to try and win, but up against, you know, people like Andy Moore and Surikhan and Hara and then Reinhardt, you know, and others that came along. It really was the best of the best in the world going head to head in touring car racing.
Yeah, it really was. And it kind of, I'd say that was probably I don't want to say that was that was a race where everybody, I mean, that was, you know, Associated had their, They had their prototype, I think TC5 maybe at the time.
And that'd be right. Yep.
It was people were still really pushing, you know, Associated was still heavily involved, and it was kind of the heyday.
And that, you know, that's spelled out by the fact that over this period, the Reedy Touring Car race has become a really big deal as well, particularly on that to me, a racetrack that got used for quite a few of those. But, you know, that's something that had everybody around the world tuning in. I'm guessing you got to race in some of those Reedy Touring Car races.
Yeah, that was probably the best times of, I mean, it was super competitive, and the Tamiya track was kind of the premier track in the U.S. also. And it was, it's like 5 minutes from my house. So
nice.
It was just, it was one of those things, like, you know, you could stay at home and race this race. I didn't have to stay at a hotel, and it was very competitive and full field. The best drivers, everybody came. There were no, oh, so-and-so is not here. So, you know, no one could say that's why anyone won. It was really great. And it's unfortunate the track's closed now, but
such an iconic racetrack.
It's been, you know, torn down and built on, but no, those were great times. Super competitive.
So, I mean, in that period around 2007, I think you joined rejoined the Reedy Associated organization. Did that start as a driving deal and then grow to include the kind of product manager roles that you're doing now? Or did you go to work for the company and you were just driving on the side?
Well, it started off as driving.
Yeah.
But it was, I had left on 2007, this all happened. I'd left kind of a long story, complicated story, but my wife also works in the RC industry, and she worked for Tamiya for many years. And then when I was at Team Orion, she came over and worked at Team Orion with me as a sales manager. And she works at Associated now as a sales manager. And as my time at Team Orion was coming to an end, there were some, I don't know exactly how it all worked out, but I knew I wasn't going to have a job, and she got an offer to work at Associated. So she went to Team Associated while I was still at Team Orion.
Okay.
And it turns out that Barry Baker was sort of the number one guy at Associated at the time. And I don't know if he left the team or kicked off the team. I don't even remember how it went down. Anyway, I was like, well, they need a guy, so maybe
I'll be the guy,
you know, I'll go run for them. So I checked in, and they were, you know, they're all, yeah, great. And I got signed on with Associated as a driver, was getting paid, you know, drive, and you know, it's kind of like, you know, that was really the first time I'd ever been paid, even though I won a bunch of races. But because I was always doing my own thing, when I was different, it wasn't just, hey, we want you to race for us, just to race for us. I was racing because it was promoting my brand and the brands I worked for.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that all kind of happened about the time I left Team Orion, and then I was stuck for a couple summer months without a job and was just, you know, playing around. And Associated had decided that they needed to do something with the Reedy brand. Mike Reedy was in bad health and was retired or was retiring. And, you know, they made the decision. It's like, well, do we let the Reedy name go, or do we try to build it back up again? And at the time, Associated was selling LRP in the U.S. So their electronics needs were sort of covered. It wasn't like they had to have the Reedy brand to have, you know, motors and batteries and stuff. But they decided that, hey, we want to build this brand up, and they brought me on to do that. So that's how I kind of got started. It was technically as a driver, but it was only shortly after that I started working there.
Can I ask you, Rick, you know, with your relationship with Associated over many, many years in different ways, and, you know, with running your own motor company, you know, up against Reedy, you know, through that 80s and 90s, what, that must have been a really significant thing, in a sense, for you to be entrusted with that name, you know, that Reedy name by the organization. I'm just, you know, I guess I'm reading, you know, I'm reading into it, but I'm imagining that that's a pretty significant kind of moment in which they say, hey, we're going to trust this name to you. And, you know, that's meant so much to so many people, and including you yourself in different ways over the years. Was that pretty special?
Well, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, there's only a couple, you know, you're talking, you know, names that have been around and, you know, the history and, you know, I mean, Reedy name, Mike Reedy has been around since pretty much the beginning of RC car racing or very, you know, very close to it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's an important name in the industry. So to be able to kind of, you know, say, hey, we want to build this back up, you know, that was a pretty big honor. And what can you say? It's
a special name. Yeah.
You know, they say, hey, we need to do this. And for him, it's kind of a lot of pressure. You know, you don't want to have bad products. You want to make sure that it's, you know, everyone's happy and that it lives up to the image that everyone has in their mind about what Reedy products are and competitiveness and Reedy, I couldn't do what he did. He was like the team manager for Associated and Reedy, and he was, it's more more of part of his life that I could make it part of mine. I mean, he lived, breathed RC racing and the drivers and the team.
Yeah.
So he was a good guy for RC, and definitely. I couldn't live up to that, but I just do my best and, you know, try to, you know, move it forward and make him proud.
So I do want to ask you a little bit about where that all sits now in terms of electronics. But before we do that, I guess I'm a little bit curious about the end of touring car and 12 scale to a degree for Team Associated. You know, we see that prototype TC5 you talked about. There was the 6 and then the 7, but the company's been out of the touring car and on road game now for a few years. Was that really just a numbers thing? You know, the rise of 8 scale off road really taking over, or you know, what was it that for Team Associated meant, you know, this is not something that we can continue to do for the time being?
It was probably a numbers thing and, you know, a decision where you have to decide, hey, are we just going to continue to, you know, do this at this level, or are we going to try to sell more and win more races and, you know, it's a difficult thing. It takes a lot of effort to be fast in any of the categories. It's not, you know, I mean, even in rock crawling, where there isn't even so much a competition like we think of a race. Of a race. I mean, to make the stuff handle, it takes a lot of testing and a lot of engineering and it's the same in on road. It takes a lot of testing, and we just didn't have the ability to test. Didn't have the manpower to put a full time effort into it. So it didn't make sense to continue. Yeah. You know, we could put the manpower into something else and be more successful. Like 8 scale nitro wasn't always we do really well now, but it wasn't always like that. It took a long time to get to a level where we're winning, or capable of winning worlds and every single big race.
Yeah.
We're a factor, but it wasn't that way. Mm. You know, and something like 12 scale, you don't sell a lot of cars.
No.
It's hard to justify spending the money unless you can sell a lot, and there was no guarantee that you could you come out with the best car and maybe you'll sell, you know, 1,000 12 scale cars a year instead of 500.
Yeah.
But, you know, for a big company, that's not very many cars.
No, it's a return on investment.
Like
kind
an
of RTR thing. Yeah.
or an off-road car.
Yeah.
And, the category changes so quickly too that, you know, you have to have new stuff every year. And it's not just, you know, you can come out with a car and it's good for 2 years.
No.
People expect a new car every season or, you know, a lot of hop-up parts. And it just, it was just impossible to keep up. It just wasn't, you know, financially, and, you know, we just didn't have the manpower.
Yeah. Fair. Seems fair. I'm guessing, you know, not anytime soon, but I'm assuming that the team does keep an eye on all the different categories, and you know, you'd probably never say never, but maybe not anytime soon. We'll see you guys back on road.
I would doubt it in the, well, I don't want to say never.
No.
I think in its current form, probably never. But, you know, I mean, On Road was Pro 10. On Road was pan cars for a very long time. And then all of a sudden, On Road was touring cars.
Yeah.
So who knows what? I mean, we could see a, you know, off road cars converted to on road cars again. And maybe it,
who knows,
you know, revitalize On Road in some different way.
Yeah.
So that could happen, but you know, I don't think we're going to have a new 12 scale or pan car, touring car anytime soon.
Fair enough. We're nearly done. Tell me a little bit about your current role with AE. You're still on that electrical side, right? Keeping an eye on all the electrical side of things with the company, from Reedy Motors, batteries, ESCs, etc. That's your kind of purview, all that stuff.
Yes, technically anything electronic related, and that can also include some of our factory team branded items, and it also includes RTR electronics. So even beyond what might say Reedy on it, it kind of falls under my watch, and it's you know, pretty much everything involved with it from start to finish, I have a hand in it. And yeah, it's a frustrating business, but it's rewarding. I mean, it's gotten to be, you know, there's just, it's kind of an odd thing, because you know, you look back at the 80s and it was almost as primitive as some of the things were, it was almost more organized back then as a, you know, now it's a little bit more, freestyle almost. Like back in the 80s, I mean, you'd go to a track and you'd be expected to follow the for us, it was raw rules at a club race. I mean, you didn't show up with something that, you know, I mean, if you showed up with something that, hey, that's not legal, you wouldn't be allowed to race. But now it's just kind of like, run whatever you want. We don't care. You're our customer, you know.
Yeah.
And cheating is way worse now than it was back then, and manufacturers cheating as well, not just, I don't think drivers purposely cheat. I think it's manufacturers cheating, and they're putting in drivers in positions where they're cheating, or maybe cheating isn't the right word, maybe using products outside of the rules, and they don't even know it, which I think is pretty crappy, there's not a lot you can do. You know, the racers don't seem bothered by it, so, you know, they're the ones who pay the bills, and if they don't care, then I don't care. They're fine with me.
Yeah,
I don't like it, but what are you going
to
do?
Yeah, it must be a hard thing to keep on top of. I mean, the changes in the electronic side of things over the last, let's say, 15 years since, you know, LiPo and brushless emerge in 2006, 2007, extraordinary, right? And the technology that's in the products, you know, from a race perspective is where I always come from, but extraordinary changes over that period. You know, you guys must be working flat out just to keep track, in a sense, of all of the development that's going on, and to keep your own products up to date.
It's difficult. We've just added some engineers on this. You know, we don't have engineers dedicated to electronics or certain things, but we have some new people. So we're able to do more in the electronics department on the mechanical side. So we've designed a new spec motor or stock motor, however people refer to them, the 17.5, 13.5, et cetera. Yeah. We're releasing that next month. So that's a design that we did all in-house. So that's kind of one of the first projects. But other things like that are coming down the line. But, you know, things have stabilized a bit with electronics. It's more about the software side and tuning, and that's stabilized a bit. There's not a whole lot you can do. And motors, we're kind of seeing you know, a limit as well. You know, the unless someone goes far outside the rules, which they do in some categories, but it's definitely changing. But we're at a point where these changes are really small. They're not these huge leaps like they have been in the past.
It does seem that we're at a point, particularly in the open classes, if I stay there rather than in the spec classes, you know, there is more power than anybody could possibly need. And, you know, even in every category, almost, we're dialing down the power, managing the delivery of power through the software, you know, as you say. So it's, nobody needs more power, I guess, is what I'm thinking about.
Well, that's the frustrating thing about, you know, we have this, we don't have a lot of mod class racers in the US. Spec racing has taken over, but to me, mod, you know, it's more about controlling the power than it is producing outright maximum power like it is in the spec classes. And creating outright maximum power costs a lot of money, whereas the tuning requires a little more testing and knowledge, which I don't know, maybe it's easier just to buy the power than it is to gain the knowledge, which could be why spec racing is a little bit more popular, you know, but that's frustrating. I think, I don't know why anyone wouldn't race mod. It's like, hey man, you can have more power than you ever want. You don't have to use it. You can dial it out. Yeah. You have everything at your fingertips, but you would rather go somewhere and spend a lot of money to try to keep up because you need as much power as possible. But that's, for me as a mod racer, and I can get around the track without crashing, and a lot of people can't. I probably have a view that's not realistic.
No, it's potentially a view that I would share with you. I find it interesting to look around the world, and you know, the size and importance of spec racing in the US is, you know, would seem quite different to, say, in Europe. And then Australia, you know, and probably Asia, it's somewhere in between. You know, certainly in by the numbers, there are more people racing stock or spec in Australia, but there is a kind of a what's the right terminology here? But there's an expectation, or there is a recognition that mod is actually the, you know, where the best guys end up. And if you want to be the best in the country, you've got to go play in mod. Stock spec racing is fantastic.
Yeah,
it really matters. But you're not the best if you're not racing mod.
The good thing about the spec racing, especially in Europe, is they, and a little bit in Asia, I don't know the details in Asia so much, but they're using, you know, handout motors, and they're using, it's like the old days of stock class racing where you have handouts, everyone has the same thing. You don't have to, you know, worry about people showing up with something that's not illegal. Everyone's on an equal playing field. So that is a positive about spec racing and the way it should be, to have guys show up that will full factory guys getting paid and then racing against basically your, you know, guys who, you know, have a year experience, or, you know, rookies, you know, against the factory guys. That's not really too cool.
Fair. Not a situation which we'll solve in this podcast in this moment. So we'll park that one. One last question on the electronic side. Just curious about whether from where you sit, you know, and what you see, anything new coming down the line? And I guess I'm particularly thinking about battery chemistries. You know, LiPo has been a love-hate relationship for lots of people. As you know, are there new technologies that you're starting to kind of hear about, you know, that we might see out in the open over the next few years that might challenge LiPo?
I don't see anything that's in the near future. I mean, the only thing that really, the lithium iron phosphate batteries, LFP batteries, I think that they're less powerful, they are cheaper, and they are less volatile. So I think that could be something that could be popular in some classes where people might think that the speeds are too high. it'd be a way to slow cars down and improve safety, lower the cost of the batteries. Of course, I think when, you know, if you get the racers involved, they'll somehow, the prices will end up, you know, things will end up ending up where they are now anyway. But
we'll find a way
to technology. Yeah. And that's not even new technology. That's the older technology. But I can see that there's some discussions about 112th mod now here in the U.S. So that'd be too fast. How do we slow the cars down? That would be a way to do it, is to introduce the LFP chemistry. You'd have lower voltage and you'd slow the cars down just overnight, and you wouldn't necessarily lose much runtime. You would lose some, but, you know, there's talk of going, I didn't even think that AOC race they ran, maybe ran 6 minute qualifiers instead of eight. So, and they're talking about that here too. So something like that, I think, is where things would go, or possibly even, you know, on the motor side, maybe smaller, less powerful motors across the board.
Maybe we'll be back to 380 motors from from back in the day. We'll see. We'll see. Yeah. Beautiful. Well, that's really helpful.
A 12 scale car with a 380 motor, I think the thing would be pretty awesome. It'd be fast and it would be lighter and it would lower CG. It'd be, it would be a good, if you built it around it, it would be really, you know, maybe even a little smaller battery, it would be a pretty awesome car.
Would be pretty cool. Rick, to finish, I want to go back to you, the racer, and I particularly wanted to ask you about your incredible longevity as a competitive force. You know, you got started in 1982, those first nationals in 1986. That's kind of 35 years ago. You've TQ'd the Raw Nats, kind of, I think it was it 2016? You know, 30 years after your first kind of nationals. You're still a highly competitive kind of fast racer. You talked about having a race coming up. I imagine you'll be going there to be competitive. What is it that's enabled you to stay fast for so long? What is it about you and the way you've gone about your racing?
I don't know. I want to say it's just I have a lot of skill, but I mean, that's obviously part of it. I mean, you have to be good, but I, probably in my particular case, it's not really taking any breaks, so that as each category has progressed, I've kind of progressed with it. I know there are a lot of people who are fast that you know, come, that maybe have quit racing and then they come back to it after, you know, a few years, or they get, you know, they get excited about it again. But when you miss this transition, like, I think if some guy was racing touring cars, you know, at Tamiya with brushed motors, and they came back today to race a brushless touring car with LiPo batteries and then, you know, tires we have now, it'd be a huge transition. So I think just staying with it and evolving as the cars evolve is probably the biggest help. It's just, you know, there's nothing, I'm not surprised by anything because I've lived through it all.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I want to take you right back to the beginning of our conversation, you know, when we talked about where this all began for you, and you talked about that, you know, as a kid, just wanting to be a race car driver. And that's really what, you know, you didn't kind of have a toy you played with in the backyard and then discovered racing. You were drawn to this to be a race car driver. As you know, what's this meant to you over the 40 years of your career to be able to be that race car driver, to travel the world, to race against the best, to win incredible races, to work in the industry? You know, if you look at it through the lens of that kind of 13-year-old kid wanting to be a race car driver, has it lived up to your hopes and expectations?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, obviously, I would have liked to win a world. I mean, I think everybody thinks getting into it, man, I've been the ultimate. Yeah. So that would have been, that's probably the one thing I wish I maybe had tried for more. I think I didn't, at times I didn't try as hard as I could have. I wasn't as dedicated on the racing side as I could have. But no, it's great to be able to say, I think for anybody in any field, that at any one point you were the best. And I can say I was the best when I won, you know, best in the U.S. or best at this particular race. And I beat every other guy who was, you know, later on at the Nationals, I'll admit the competition wasn't as good as it was, you know, earlier when I raced, but, you know, when I won the Reedy race, I beat the best. I was literally the best RC car racer in the world at that given event and that given point in time. So to know that what you've done, you know, and same on the motor side or the motor production side, you know, we were the best at a certain point. So that's satisfying. I mean, can't really, you know, you can't get better than the best.
No, it's a pretty nice place to finish. A man who has been, continues to be driven by the heart of a competitor to be a race car driver, and has stood on the top of the podium along the way. Rick, thank you so much for taking a whole chunk of your time as we've prepared to kind of chat today. And as we've chatted, I have really appreciated your time and your generosity.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
I've got 1,000 questions left. Folks, as I always say every week, there's always another bunch of things I'd love to hear about, but we'll maybe save those for another day. Folks, thanks for being with us today. I just wanted to, as we wrap up, I'll also say that I think we'll be pushing these podcasts out to be fortnightly, just trying to work on this project solo. The time commitment's getting a little tricky to manage. So we'll push these out to a fortnightly release starting from this episode on, but still looking to release every fortnight, every second Wednesday. Some great conversations coming up with some people from right around the world, as well as here in Australia. For now, though, and for this week, thanks again to Rick. And folks, thank you for being with us. I hope you have a great time at the racetrack this weekend.